As the diplomats talk, the war rages on. Today, Tuesday, September 17th, this is The World. I'm Aaron Schachter in for Marco Werman. Diplomats at the UN continue to negotiate a resolution on Syria's chemical weapons, but on the ground in Syria, the civil war seems endless.
Nobody's winning in Syria. Everybody's losing. What we have is a stalemate, and that stalemate has been going on for about a year.
We ask, what could tip the balance in Syria? Also today, a Russian cookbook author who grew up in the Soviet era remembers going to her first American supermarket.
It was as huge as Red Square and just packed with absolutely everything. And my mother would go swooning, oh, Cheerios, Velveeta.
Plus, the technical glitch that let Iranians directly onto Twitter and Facebook just for a few hours.
Support for PRI's The World comes from Medtronic, celebrating 25 new global heroes, runners who didn't let a diagnosis of chronic disease end their run, at the Medtronic Twin Cities Marathon this October 6th. More at Medtronic.com.
I'm Aaron Schachter in for Marco Werman, and this is The World. The civil war in Syria is raging on. It's hard to tell some days with all the attention focused on the diplomats trying to hammer out a deal on Syria's chemical weapons. But on the ground, the fighting grinds on and people are dying. For an update on the war, we turn to Joshua Landis, director of the Center for Middle Eastern Studies at the University of Oklahoma. I started by asking him who's winning in Syria.
Nobody's winning in Syria. Everybody's losing. What we have is a stalemate, and that stalemate has been going on for about a year. The U.S. is supplying help and weapons to the rebels, but not enough for them to win, just enough so that they don't lose. And that is a policy of stalemate.
Not only is there a stalemate, but there seems to be quite a bit of fighting between the rebels themselves. That's what we're hearing recently. Secular and jihadi factions are going at each other. Is there any way that this group we call rebels, the opposition, can stay together?
Well, there's going to be a big shakedown. There are over 1,000 militias. Some of them are related to al-Qaeda. Others are very Islamist, but in a coalition with the al-Qaeda-related groups. And the others are what we call FSA, Free Syrian Army, and are attached to the United States. That's a very broad generalization because there are a lot of free-floating militias as well. But those two major factions are beginning to fight it out for control over very strategic parts of this rebel-owned Syria, the north and the east of the country. And that is what we're seeing because as the stalemate goes on, the real question is who gets to control the strategic parts of this free Syria, if you will, or the rebel-controlled Syria.
We're talking now about what seems like a diplomatic breakthrough between the U.S. and Russia over Syria's chemical weapons. To the rebels, it seems almost like a betrayal. They were hoping for U.S. military action, Western military action in Syria. I imagine they must be incredibly disheartened. What happens now for them?
They are disheartened. On the other hand, the first shiploads of American arms have gotten through to the opposition. And for a long time, even though President Obama had said that he was going to begin to arm the rebels, the last time chemical weapons were used, this is way back in May, those weapons are only beginning to be delivered recently. So there is some good news for the rebels, which is that America is stepping up its role and its support. But at the same time, the rebels had become very hopeful that Turkey, Saudi Arabia, that the European powers would really jump in and that the chemical weapons would shift the balance of power and mean that the West was finally going to take it to the Assad regime. And that has not turned out to be the case.
Finally, Josh, videos have emerged this week that the BBC has concluded show Iranians fighting for Assad in Syria. This comes on top of Hezbollah's admission that they've intervened earlier this year. Could that help tip the balance in favor of Assad, those two forces working together?
Well, they have tipped the balance. I mean, a year ago, it looked like Assad really had his back to the wall and was losing territory. Hezbollah, Iran stepped up their participation, and then momentum went on the regime side. Today, we're back to the same old, you know, stagnant battle lines. But there aren't enough Shiites in Syria. The Shiites are only about 13% of all Syria. They cannot rule over this country again. There's even a big question about whether the Assad regime can maintain control of Damascus. We've seen that many of the – Damascus is overwhelmingly Sunni city, and it's boiling with opposition. And what we're seeing in a sense here is a renegotiation of ethnic power in Syria between Shiites, 12%, Sunni Arabs, about 60%, Kurds, 10% in the northeast. Then, of course, there's other minorities making up another 10% or so, the Christians and so forth. But that ethnic readjustment from a position where the minorities and the Alawite minority in particular had their foot on the necks of the Sunni majority for the last 50 years. And now they've lost that hold. They're fighting to maintain something. We don't know how much. And that's what's really in question today is how much does the Assad regime hold on to, if anything, or does it finally collapse?
Joshua Landis, thank you for joining us.
It's a pleasure.
Joshua Landis is director of the Center for Middle Eastern Studies at the University of Oklahoma. Talks at the United Nations over a deal to secure and dispose of Syria's chemical weapons are at a thorny stage right now. The U.S. and Russia disagree on what should happen if Syria doesn't comply. The two sides also have different views on who is behind the poison gas attack near Damascus last month. Washington blames the Assad regime. Today, Moscow pointed its finger at the rebels. So, how do you negotiate with someone whose version of the truth differs so greatly from yours? I put that question to a man who's been closely involved in these kinds of negotiations before. Jeremy Greenstock is Britain's former ambassador to the United Nations and that country's special envoy to Iraq in the early days of the U.S.-led invasion.
In these sorts of negotiations, you look for compromise language in a resolution. You look to your capitals to see how much wiggle room they've got to get to the next stage, to the next stepping stone in the midst of what is about to happen over the next 2 or 3 weeks. And actually, clever diplomats are pretty good at finding a middle point, and then it's up to the capitals to accept that or reject it.
Now, the entire debate here over Western military intervention in Syria is, of course, being affected by the last time we had a debate of this size and consequence, and that was back in Iraq, which you were part of. Has that essentially ruined any chance of Western military powers going into Syria?
It hasn't ruined them, but it's made Western public opinion and Western parliaments and congresses much more wary of authorizing the use of force when they can't see what consequences may stem from it. That's what they were annoyed with, irritated with, and disappointed with over Iraq. Afghanistan hasn't turned out that well either. And I think Western countries are becoming much more wary of stepping into territory that is clearly the legitimate sovereign area for somebody else. The world has changed in that way. So there is a wariness. On the other hand, you need security. You need somebody to be a global policeman at odd moments of high crisis. And the UN should be that if its member states can get their act together. And the United States is always an important part of that.
When you've spoken about Iraq, you've used the word legitimacy quite often. Is it legitimate for the United States and France to just take action, regardless of what the public thinks?
I think there's a problem in that. It was a considerable disadvantage that we didn't bring enough international opinion along with us over Iraq. We were slowly starved of outside political and then material support. That matters nowadays when the use of force and the threat of the use of force is much more frowned upon by international opinion. And legitimacy is a matter of opinion in the international arena. There's no Supreme Court that actually pronounces judgment on these things. Legality is also, it's something different from legitimacy, is also important here because it's part of people accepting that something is right. And it would be very difficult to establish the legality of any strike unless the UN authorised it. And the Russians are very aware of that. So international opinion could go in either direction, against the use of force or against doing nothing to help the Syrian people. That's what makes this so difficult and so interesting.
You know, much has been made in this country, in both countries, the U.S. and Britain, about a lack of planning when it came to Iraq. The war was executed, but what came next didn't seem to be fully thought out. It seems a fair question now for those governments who would like to see Assad go. What comes next?
Yes, it's something I've given a lot of thought to. I think we're in a very similar position. Neither in Afghanistan, nor in Iraq, nor in Libya have we been in any sense clear of whether there was a leader who could take over and unite the country and take it to a more peaceful era. Very often in these circumstances, with a brutal autocracy, good people have been exiled or executed or have disappeared, who might have led the next stage. We don't know what will come in the next stage in Syria. There might even be another civil war to come. So we must be very careful not to own the situation when we can't control it.
That was Jeremy Greenstock, Britain's former special envoy in Iraq and former British ambassador to the UN. The debate over possible international action in Syria also prompts memories of Bosnia back in the 1990s. Back then, thousands of Bosnians fled their war-torn homeland and came to the U.S. as refugees. Today, many of them see history repeating itself as more and more Syrians are forced to flee their homes. As part of our Global Nation coverage, reporter Shuka Kalantari spoke with Bosnian refugees in California for their perspective on what it's like to start over as a refugee.
I'm in San Francisco with Seni Felic, a Bosnian who opened his own restaurant a few years ago with a childhood friend from his hometown. Felic is a refugee. He fled to the U.S. in 1994 after Serbian troops started bombing his city. For him, he says, those first few years in the U.S. were the hardest.
You have to daily deal with new culture, new ideas, new language, new food, new smell of air. You know, it's like very... It felt, at the same time, very liberating, but at the same time, very, very emotional, you know.
Felic came to the U.S. without any friends or family. So he says the friends he made here became his family. He says if he could offer one piece of advice to the wave of Syrians now being torn away from their families, it'd be this. Build friendships and community in your new home.
It's really, you know, like important to seek out and make family from people you never seen in your life. So you have your family and you lose it and you go to somewhere else and you create family from people you never seen around. So you seek more to interact with other humans.
Amir Muzic has his own story of survival, of when he had to flee Bosnia. His situation was only made more urgent because of his mixed marriage. Muzic, a Muslim, is married to an Orthodox Serbian.
My wife was working with the army, Yugoslav People Army, and thanks to a major who worked with my wife, he told her, take your family and get out by 9 o'clock in the morning and don't come back until I tell you.
Muzic says he and his wife had 1 hour to pack their bags, round up their two children, and leave the country. Within a few hours after they left, Serbian troops surrounded his city and began arresting people.
Later on, I learned that they actually made a list of people who are going to be executed. So I was on the list. So
you were on the list of people that were going to be executed.
Yeah.
So if you literally didn't leave that morning...
I wouldn't be talking to you now. I wouldn't be talking to you right now.
Today, Muzic helps resettle other refugees through his job at the International Rescue Committee in Oakland. What's his advice for Syrians? He says if they're in the position to resettle to the U.S. or elsewhere, they should do it, immediately. Because even if the Syrian war ends soon, it'll take years to rebuild the country, like in Bosnia.
It'll take really, really long time for things to get better, and they will never be the same, believe me. Never be the same. After the war, nothing is the same. Especially if you have children, young children, why waste your time? Why prevent children for getting better life?
Muzic doesn't agree with U.S. military action in Syria, but he also doesn't think the world should stand by and watch when something can be done right now, helping Syrian refugees. For The World, I'm Shuka Kalantari in San Francisco.
You're listening to The World on PRI.
The World is brought to you by PRI with help from Medtronic, celebrating 25 new global heroes, runners who didn't let a diagnosis of chronic disease end their run at the Medtronic Twin Cities Marathon this October 6th. More at Medtronic.com.
I'm Aaron Schachter, and this is The World. Imagine the history of the Soviet Union from the standpoint of the stomach. From the starving peasants who helped topple the Tsar in 1917 to grain requisitioning and ration cards on to Soviet caviar and champagne. It's all there and more in a new book called Mastering the Art of Soviet Cooking. Reporter Bridget McCarthy caught up with the author in New York City.
Anya von Bremsen has always had a complicated relationship with food. She says it's just part of her heritage. She was born in Moscow in 1963.
I grew up in an apartment where 18 families shared one kitchen.
Her new book, Mastering the Art of Soviet Cooking, is not a cookbook. It's both a family memoir and a survey of Soviet history from the kitchen table. She says food was enormously important throughout the Soviet Union's tumultuous history.
It was the most essential issue from the revolution until the very end.
Both politically and personally. Because the Soviet state didn't just dictate where its 300 million citizens worked and lived, but also what they put in their mouths, which most of the time wasn't much. Von Bremsen's mother, Larissa, is 79, and she says food was always on her mind.
Any period of my Soviet life, it was lack of food, it was shortage of food, it was difficult to buy, it was difficult to find. And food became kind of obsession for most Russians.
Larissa remembers her own mother's heroic efforts to feed her family during the hungry years of the Second World War.
Also, we always wanted something sweet. It was really a terrible thing for children not to have anything sweet.
For Larissa, a slice of black bread sprinkled with a few granules of sugar was a heavenly treat. As an adult, Larissa loved to cook. She had grand ambitions, but not much to work with in the way of ingredients. So she and her young daughter, Anya, feasted vicariously, devouring descriptions of freshly salted caviar, flaky fish pies, and racks of lamb in the stories of Gogol and Chekhov.
And all this, you know, orgiastic, you know, food porn from 19th century Russian literature. And we just imagined what this stuff would taste like. We had absolutely no idea. Or my mom would read Proust or Hemingway. And we would just go to sleep discussing, well, what do you think a madeleine really is? Is it kind of like a jam-filled pierogi? Or is it... We had absolutely zero idea what pizza was.
When Anya was almost 11, she and her mother immigrated to the land of plenty. This was in 1974. They were among the first wave of Soviet Jews allowed to emigrate. They ended up in Philadelphia.
And I'll never forget our first trip to the Pathmark. It was as huge as Red Square and just packed with absolutely everything. And my mother would go swooning, oh, Cheerios, Velveeta. She was so excited. And I felt like it was a tomb of all my desires and dreams about the West. Because once you saw the abundance, who cared? It lost its value.
Von Bremsen realized that imagining food was a lot more thrilling than having it. Besides, she didn't even like American food. She wanted Moscow bread, not Wonder Bread. She found Pop-Tarts and peanut butter revolting. She had a hard time adjusting. So she escaped into music. She graduated from Juilliard with hopes of becoming a concert pianist. But then, in her mid-20s, she developed a ganglion cyst on her wrist and had to stop playing for a while. To earn money, she translated a cookbook from Italian, a language she'd learned during a brief sojourn in Rome.
And here I was, you know, thinking about, you know, Allegro con brio and Andante spianato and, you know, writing about spinach and, you know, pesto. And then I thought, oh, this is interesting, you know, cookbooks.
By the time she'd finished, the lump on her wrist was nearly gone. But so was her passion for piano. Writing Italian recipes had unexpectedly reawakened her fascination with food.
Food was really deep, deep, deep in my psyche, and it represented so much more than just yum, yum, what you put in your mouth.
It also represented power and prestige, lives lost and longing. Von Bremsen decided to write her own cookbook about the ethnic cuisines of the Soviet Union. It wasn't an easy sell.
Everyone said, Russia, are you kidding? Is it a book about bread lines?
But she eventually found a publisher. Pleas to the Table became an unexpected bestseller and won the James Beard Award. Her timing was interesting. The cookbook was published in 1990, the year the Soviet Union began to crumble.
And it was kind of a book about the culinary friendship, the whole multi-ethnic Soviet melting pot with all the republics, while all the republics wanted out. they were separating. So all my friends were going, oh, well, it should be a tear-off calendar, your book. So Uzbekistan going, Ukraine going.
Von Bremsen parlayed the success of Please to the Table into a career as a food writer and restaurant critic.
And here I was, you know, traveling around the world, eating at places like El Bulli or Per Se, you know, eating foie gras, whatnot. And that shadow of my former life and of my relationship to food would always be almost in every bite.
Anya von Bremsen decided to confront that shadow. Mastering the art of Soviet cooking isn't just her story. It's also the story of millions of ex-Soviets, people who remember the rapturous sensation of biting into an orange, which they could only get once a year. Anya von Bremsen isn't nostalgic for the USSR, but she does feel like her Soviet childhood was special.
Who else grew up singing odes to Lenin and wearing a young pioneer tie and putting so much kind of meaning and existential significance into everything that you ate?
She says it's surreal to come from a country and a civilization that no longer exists.
And now we're kind of looking at the ruins of it. It's like this incredible interior-exterior archaeological site that is part of our psyche.
Anya von Bremsen has retrieved from those ruins something so essential and obvious that it was hidden in plain sight. For The World, I'm Bridget McCarthy.
You can see photos from Anya von Bremsen's Soviet childhood there at theworld.org. Central Italy is where we start our GeoQuiz quest today. You've got a number of regions in that part of the boot. There's Marche to the east and Tuscany to the west. They both have coasts. The region we want you to name is in between and landlocked. Among its claims to fame, a university town that's popular with foreign students. That's Perugia. That's where those delicious Perugina sweets come from, too. This region's in the news right now for a more sinister reason. Dum, dum, dum. Police there are looking for the thieves who stole a mini horse named Charlie. He's only 2 feet tall, and he was abducted from his stable at a national horse show recently. Charlie's owner is devastated. He says he's expecting a demand for ransom. Apparently, Charlie is worth a bit of money because he is so small. So, in which Italian region was this heinous crime committed? That's your challenge. We're back with the answer later in the program. This is The World on PRI. I'm Aaron Schachter. Ahead on The World, Iranians enjoy a moment of easy access to Twitter and Facebook, but it didn't last long.
Some people thought it was a sign of openness. Other people were afraid that it was a sign that the Iranian government wanted to better spy on its citizens and see who was actually on Facebook. It turned out to be neither. It was a glitch.
Support for PRI's The World comes from Medtronic, celebrating 25 new global heroes, runners who didn't let a diagnosis of chronic disease end their run at the Medtronic Twin Cities Marathon this October 6th. More at Medtronic.com.
I'm Aaron Schachter, and this is The World, a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH Boston. State visits to the White House are grand affairs, with red carpets rolled out to honor Washington's closest allies. And the allies usually relish the attention. So the news today that Brazil's President Dilma Rousseff postponed her state visit to the U.S. next month has raised tensions on both sides of the equator. She's angry about revelations that the U.S. National Security Agency is snooping on the emails and phone calls of Brazilians, including Rousseff herself. The snooping was revealed by documents leaked by former NSA contractor Edward Snowden. Carolina Rossini is at the Latin American Resource Center of the Open Technology Institute. She says Brazil's irritation with the U.S. has been building for months.
With the NSA scandals, we discover surveillance, both political and of Brazilian citizens, without any protection, right? The U.S. law is flexible enough that doesn't give any protection to foreigners. And Dilma has been trying to negotiate with Obama how we can change that. And I think Obama has not been very open to any changes and any of the requests that Dilma is doing and her ministers is doing. So I think while Obama doesn't open some bilateral negotiations in that sense, she will keep canceling her trips.
Now, there are a lot of folks around the world, Europe and America, who are upset about this, but don't governments assume and leaders of governments assume that they're all spying on each other somehow?
That's what everybody expects for many years, right? There is a joke that if you take the painting out of the UN, you're going to have microphones from every country. But one thing is political surveillance, which is also not something that we like. But the problem is when it inflicts the life of private citizens that don't have any relation with the justifications concerning national security or terrorism, then I think the picture changes.
The ire that we're hearing from Brazil is rising above anger from just about anywhere else. Why is this happening? Why is President Dilma Rousseff so upset?
I think after the street protests in Brazil and what happened with the NSA issue and the Sweden revelations, Dilma finally engaged directly with this. And she had many meetings during Sundays. And this just happened when it's an urgent matter, when it's a matter at the president level. So I think that she finally woke up for how important this is all. And Brazil is in a moment now that we are actually providing internet for developing countries. We have set international submarine backbones to Africa and part of the Caribbean. So we are a pretty strong power on the infrastructure side. And Dilma, I think she wants to have some saying or more saying on how the internet works worldwide.
Now, President Rousseff has talked about cutting off Brazil from the American internet in a variety of ways, like creating a state-run email service, perhaps laying an underwater cable directly to Europe so it bypasses the U.S. Is this really possible?
Well, it is possible. I don't know if it's the best solution, right? We still have many countries dependable on the ISPs and so on that come from US and the big companies. And because of that, if you see the map of internet traffic, most of the communications do pass through the US. So I think it's understandable that a country wants to be less dependent, because if we are less dependent, we also gonna be probably more in control and less open for this type of surveillance, right?
There are a lot of common interests that Brazil and the U.S. have: oil exploration, biofuel technology, and Brazil is talking about purchasing fighter jets from Boeing. If things are this bad with Brazil, a country that's friendly to the U.S., that doesn't seem like it bodes well for the rest of the region.
Other countries are waiting to see what Brazil can do. Dilma is coming to the U.S. next week, specifically to New York, for the UN General Assembly meeting, where she will talk about all these issues, including the need for respect for human rights, the internet, and how concerned she is with how broad the surveillance is. So I think then we're going to see how other countries of the region will react.
Okay. Carolina Rossini, Project Director for the Latin America Resource Center at the Open Technology Institute, thank you for joining us.
Thank you very much.
Internet users in Iran had a big surprise yesterday. Many of them discovered they were able to access Facebook and Twitter directly. Normally, those sites are blocked by the Iranian government, and users have to go through a proxy server outside Iran to access them. When the firewall went down, hundreds of Iranian Facebook and Twitter users posted celebratory messages, but the joy didn't last long. A few hours later, the sites were blocked again. Zeynep Tufekci is an assistant professor at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill, and we talk to her regularly about technology and society. First, Zeynep, tell us what happened yesterday. Why was it that Facebook and Twitter were directly accessible? Was it a symbol of new openness or just a goof-up?
It turns out to have been a glitch. When it was
when people started posting freely without using a VPN, which is a service that lets you get around Iran's filter net, we were really surprised. And there was a lot of discussion on whether it was a symbol of opening with, you know, Iranian president now being on Twitter and tweeting openly. Maybe this was a symbol that they were going to let their citizens access the internet freely. But quickly, it turned out that that wasn't the case, that it was actually a glitch in their what people in Iran are calling the filter net, which is the sort of nationalized internet, which doesn't really let the users freely go to a lot of websites that are outside of Iran. Another possibility that people discussed was what had happened in Syria, in which the Syrian regime actually removed blocks that it had on Facebook and other sites early into the rebellion, with pretty clearly the intention was to surveil and, you know, sort of follow and spy on their citizens.
So the idea would be that the first people to jump on are kind of the online leaders, and you want to catch them.
Well, that might have been the idea, but in Iran right now, we have about 1 million people that are at least, you know, using one VPN, a service that lets you get around Iran's blockage. And we seem to have about 10 to 20 million Iranians who are on Facebook anyway. So it's pretty clear these sites, even though they're blocked, they're very, very widely used on by Iranians. So what the government might want to do might be to try to spy on their citizens more effectively, because right now what they're doing is using these, you know, VPNs, these private networks that encrypt the communication so that the government cannot see what the users are doing. So if you didn't need to use the VPN anymore, you might use sort of the regular internet, which is more vulnerable to spying and being, you know, observed.
Yeah, there were some stories in the last week or so about the new president, Rouhani, being a big Twitterer. I just followed him last week. And yet, as you say, normal Iranians are denied direct access. I mean, maybe does this suggest a change, Rouhani, and even from what I understand, the Supreme Leader being on Twitter?
Well, it doesn't seem to suggest a change for normal people. It seems like they're trying to use these new tools to kind of make certain statements and reach out to Western audiences. But it really doesn't look like the parts of the Iranian government in control of the internet access are about to let up anytime soon. In fact, what we saw was that as soon as the Twitter and Facebook started becoming accessible, they started being shut down on some selective ISPs and not others through alternative means. So what probably happened was that the nationwide control had a glitch. So a lot of local ISPs kind of jumped up with their makeshift blocking software, and some of them did and did not. So we saw a little patchwork for a while.
Now, I was recently in China, which is another country that blocks Facebook and Twitter, and yet just about everyone I came across were using these things, were going on Twitter and Facebook. Is there really a point in countries blocking these things anymore when, as you say, you can get around those blocks?
Well, there is a point. What you said is true. In Iran, we have 10 to 20 million users of Facebook and Twitter. And in China, there's a segment of the population that really is online on the internet using VPNs. But the people you interacted with were probably the kind of people who are more able to reach abroad, who are more privileged, whereas it'll keep a lot of regular people who are kind of afraid of using these VPNs, these private networks, off the internet. And that's the case in China. It's the kind of people you are more likely to meet are probably all online, you know, globally, but average use of these services is very low. The second thing that's pretty important for governments to consider, and this is sort of a dilemma for them, is that if they push their people into these sort of private networks, which are encrypted, then they can't spy on them. So the governments have a balancing act, too. They have to try to figure out how much to restrict, because the more they restrict, the more people get interested in circumvention, which, by the way, has a huge domestic story angle. Last week, it was revealed that our National Security Agency was working to weaken encryption standards, which are used globally, so that it could spy on, you know, whatever it wants to spy on easier. So inadvertently, we might have been making it easier for the Iranian government to spy on its own people, too. If we're weakening encryption standards here, that means they're being weakened everywhere. And that's, you know, if we want to help the Iranians get around their government spying, that's just the opposite of what we should be doing.
Zeynep Tufekci is an assistant professor at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. She joins us often to talk about technology around the world. Zeynep, thank you.
Thank you.
The small European country of Belgium has been the subject of a couple of feel-good stories recently. Story number one, the national soccer team is the best Belgian team in decades and is on the verge of qualifying for next year's World Cup in Brazil. That is great news. Story number two, Belgium is the latest beneficiary of China's panda diplomacy. Two giant pandas will be loaned to a Belgian zoo. That announcement came earlier this month. So why, Patrick Cox, the world's language editor, are you here to talk about this?
Well, Aaron, because Belgian politicians have a habit of seeing the world through their own linguistic lenses. And let's take the soccer story first.
Okay.
There are plans to build a new soccer stadium. Those plans have been bolstered by the success of the team. And here is where the language issue rears its head. The current stadium, the old stadium, is inside Brussels, which is the only part of Belgium that's officially bilingual, meaning French and Dutch are spoken, and there have to be signs out on the streets in French and Dutch. The site for the new stadium is just outside Brussels. It's very close to the old stadium, but it's in the Dutch-speaking part of Belgium where there are no regulations calling for bilingual signs or bilingual announcements. In fact, all of those things could, in theory, be only in Dutch, even though this is a national stadium and presumably supposed to represent all Belgium. So there's a fight going on about the language of the national stadium.
Okay, fight over the national stadium. How can there possibly be a fight over pandas?
Well, the language issue has come up with these pandas because of their destination. The Belgian prime minister, who, by the way, he comes from an Italian immigrant family, which probably helps when running Belgium. He has said that a zoo in the French-speaking part of Belgium will house these giant pandas. And that has outraged people who run Belgium's most established zoo, which happens to be in Antwerp, part of the Dutch-speaking.
Well, it seems like a fair trade. One side gets a stadium, one side gets pandas, no?
I guess you could look at it like that, although I don't think there are many politicians there who are. But I do have some good news for all Belgians to report to you, Aaron. And that is that Tintin, you know Tintin,
yeah,
right? The comic book adventurer, one of Belgium's most famous fictional sons. A Tintin adventure, The Black Island, has been translated for the first time into Scots, which is, well, I suppose you might call it a dialect of English that uses a lot of non-English words, and it's spoken in Lowland Scotland. So here is a blast from The Black Island, read by the translator, Susan Rennie.
Tack tent. 3 months syne, twa lads here was bent set in visiting the isle. For by warnings and spains, they set off in a wee boat. The water was sma, the wind was loon, but neither sick nor sound has there been of them since syne.
Well, I understood a few words there.
Yeah, and I must admit, I didn't understand that many more. I had to call up the translator and say, what on earth was that? And here's how she translated it. Take care. 2 months ago, two boys insisted on going to the island, and despite warnings and foretellings, they set off in a small boat. The water was calm, the wind was mild, but there's been no sight or sound of them since.
Patrick, I wonder how many people will understand the Scots version of Tintin.
Well, Scots right now is going through a revival of sorts, but it's early days yet. This is a language that used to be spoken by a lot of people and is spoken by far fewer these days.
Well, Tintin is a good start. The world's Patrick Cox, thank you.
You're very welcome.
And you can hear and see more Tintin in Scots, and we dare you to understand it, at theworld.org. Still ahead, we go in search of a 2-foot purloined pony. You're listening to The World on PRI.
The World is brought to you by PRI, with help from Lumosity. Lumosity.com's daily workouts are designed to improve memory and attention and dedicated to helping people feel sharper, think faster, and remember more. It's all at Lumosity.com.
I'm Aaron Schachter, and this is The World. It's a whodunit with a tiny Italian horse as the unfortunate protagonist, or maybe he's a pony. Charlie is his name, and he's just 2 feet tall. He disappeared a few days ago from a national horse show in Umbria region of central Italy. That makes Umbria the answer to today's GeoQuiz. Charlie's owner says he was abducted by criminals, possibly for ransom. We dialed up Rosie Scammell to get the story. She's a journalist based in Rome for the online news service The Local. Rosie, when was Charlie stolen and where from?
Well, Charlie was at the National Horse Show in Città di Castello in Umbria and arrived there on Thursday. And on Thursday night, thieves cut through the netting surrounding the pony's enclosure and ran away with Charlie. It's not quite clear exactly how they escaped. Reports say that they escaped across a field, I imagine in a car or something similar. And when we spoke to the people who run the horse show, they told us that it was especially easy to steal Charlie because Charlie is about the size of a dog, so very easy to put in the back of a car. And Charlie was due to perform on Friday, Saturday and Sunday, but unfortunately hasn't been found.
So he was scheduled to perform. He does tricks?
Exactly. I wouldn't say that you would get Charlie doing any racing, but he's quite good at tricks.
It sounds a bit like a dog show.
Very much so.
Now, there is talk of the mafia being involved in the theft. Do we know if that's true?
I would say that when people outside of Italy hear about crimes in Italy, they assume that the mafia is involved because, of course, the mafia is very well known internationally. But I don't think that's true in this instance. That's because Umbria isn't a region that's known for the mafia. The mafia frequent areas such as Calabria in the south. So it may well have just been a local thief or someone that heard Charlie was in town and thought they'd like to hold him for ransom.
Or maybe go on a joyride with the world's smallest pony.
Perhaps.
Is Charlie at all famous, renowned in Italy? He is the smallest pony in the world, after all.
I think within the horse world, Charlie is very well known. The president of the horse show responded to the crime and said it was a serious crime and an offence to the whole of the horse world. And the owner has certainly received a lot of sympathy online from hundreds of people who have got in touch with him over the theft.
You've seen the horse, I imagine, and can you describe Charlie for us?
Yes, I can. So Charlie is a sort of a sandy coloured pony, goes up to about not even to the waist of the owner. I would say looks like a...
He sounds like a big dog.
There would probably be bigger dogs, certainly.
And we will post a picture of Charlie on our website, theworld.org. Rosie Scammell is with The Local, an online news service in Italy. She was talking with us about the theft of Charlie, the world's smallest pony from the region of Umbria in Italy. That is the answer to our geo quiz. Rosie, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.
Okay, so we don't want to suggest that we know Charlie's fate, but his story totally reminded several of my colleagues here at The World about another little horse, the one featured in a certain NBC sitcom. Okay, you little Sebastian fans out there, you know what I'm talking about. And again, who really wouldn't want to see Charlie, the amazing little horse that's missing in Italy? We have a video at theworld.org. Finally today, music from a new CD called OK Sera. Tom Schnabel of KCRW is our guest reviewer.
A new recording, an ECM recording, a live recording, just came my way by an Italian pianist named Stefano Bolani and a Brazilian bandolin player named Hamilton de Holanda. Both are virtuoso guys. They're young guys. They can pretty much play anything. This album was so utterly lovely, and they played so beautifully together that I was seduced. We've been listening to a cover version of a classic Brazilian song called Beatriz, and it starts off this new album by Stefano Bolani and Hamilton de Holanda, a live album called O Que Será, which actually just means whatever. The bandoline, by the way, is kind of a flatter, slightly squished down and slightly larger relative of the mandolin. Its cousins are the cavaquinho that came to Brazil from Portugal, and also the ukulele, which went from Portugal to Hawaii. The next track is one of my favorite tangos. It's a slow-burning tango by Astor Piazzolla called Oblivion. Always one of my favorites. When I was listening to this record and I got to this track, I just leaned back and said, oh my goodness, I have to do something about this. This is just a sensationally wonderful recording. The live album by Stefano Bolani and Hamilton de Hollanda was recorded in Antwerp, Belgium, which is part of Flanders, in the summer of 2012. The last cut on the album is a very old one, and it's a very fast one. It was written around the same time as a more famous choro called Tico Tico No Fuba by a guy named Ernesto Nazareth, who lived from 1863 to 1934. It is a mashishi, which is a form of choro and sort of a relative of the tango. The choro and the tango kind of developed at the same time at the end of the 19th century. This is a very fast piece, and it shows how the musicians just interlock, going about 400 miles an hour, musically speaking, and I think it's completely amazing. It's called a Panje de Cavaquinho. Performers, Stefano Bolani at the keyboard, Hamilton de Hollanda on the bandolin.
And that was Tom Schnabel of KCRW telling us about one of his favorite new releases, the new album OK Sera. From the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH here in Boston, I'm Aaron Schachter. Please join us again tomorrow.
Is a co-production of the BBC World Service, Public Radio International, and WGBH Boston, supported in part by the Rita Allen Foundation, investing in transformative ideas in their earliest stages to leverage their growth and promote breakthrough solutions to significant problems, online at ritaallen.org. And by the WGBH Fund for Environmental Reporting, whose donors include the Grantham Foundation for the Protection of the Environment, supporting a cooperative approach to solving our critical environmental problems while we still can, and the Candida Fund, furthering the values that contribute to a healthy planet.
PRI, Public Radio International.